he still has not heard from the three Thai banks. So, said Tira, ask yourself this, will my friend really care if those three Thai banks are now bought up by Citibank and have their standards brought up to the same level as American Express? Will he feel a sense of nationalist outrage? Maybe, but it probably won't last long if those Thai banks start re-employing people and if they suddenly start to run as efficiently and profitably as Citibank and American Express. That's the groundswell at work. You'll meet Liliana, a 32-year-old Brazilian social worker who lived in the Rocinha favela in Rio and works for the municipal government. She gave me a tour of a daycare center in the favela, and along the way she explained that she had saved for years to finally be able to move her family out. Now that they were out of the favela and into the fast world, the last thing she wanted was for that world to fold up, even if it was a struggle to get in. She said to me, "When I was young, everyone in our neighborhood in the favela had to watch TV in one house. I am now moving to a place that is 1 hour and 20 minutes from my work instead of 20 minutes, but it is not in the favela, and it is away from the crime. I am moving there for my children, because there are no drug dealers. I make 900 reals a month. Now I can buy a telephone. Now our house is made of bricks, not wood, and at the end of the month, I still have some money left. When we had inflation, no one could buy on credit because you could not afford the inflation interest rates. Today, even the poor people here have a phone. They have cable television and they have electricity. I have all the basic things that rich people have. Now we can complain about the service from the electricity or the phone company. Before, we didn't have them, so we couldn't complain about them." That's the groundswell at work. You'll meet Fatima al-Abdali, a Kuwaiti environmental health scientist who owns the most popular internet cafe in Kuwait City, Coffee Valley, where you can sip latte and surf the net. Educated in America, al-Abdali wears a veil as a sign of Islamic piety, but is a total webhead underneath. I gave a lecture on globalization in Kuwait, and she was one of the people in the audience. Afterward, she invited me to visit her cafe and meet some students there. The cafe was located in an urban shopping mall. As I sat down at a corner table, I said to her, "Look, I'm a little confused. Do the math for me. You are wearing an Islamic head covering. You are obviously a religious person. But you were educated in an American university, and now you are bringing the internet to Kuwait. I don't quite see how it all adds up." Her answer, in essence, was that so many times in the past the Arab Islamic world had been invaded by outsiders with their often alien influences and technologies. Well, she said, they were being invaded again, but this time she was going to own that invasion, not let the invasion own her. She was going to put a veil around that internet and make sure the youths who frequented her cafe used it properly. I admired the effort. Don't lash out against it. Own it yourself. "I had this idea 3 years ago for an internet cafe," she told me in 1997. "I knew it was coming, and that if I didn't open one, someone else would. I realized we can have some control over it, so let's teach people the good parts and make it consistent with our own culture, rather than wait to be invaded by it. I adopted it and adapted it, and on our webpage now we are slowly introducing some Islamic women's rights issues." Al-Abdali invited some students from Kuwait University to join us. One of them mentioned in passing that they had just held student elections at the university, and the Islamic fundamentalist candidates got wiped out by the independent, liberal, and secular parties. Student elections are very important in the Arab world because they tend to be the most free, and therefore often the most indicative of public attitudes, at least among young people. I asked Abdul Aziz Al-Shali, a 21-year-old communications student, why the Islamists were so roundly defeated. "The Islamists are not that impressive anymore," he said. the secular parties are helping the students more with the small things that students care about now. Xeroxing, email problems, library books, parking. The society is less ideological now. We need to look for a job. That's the groundswell at work. You'll meet two Australian friends of mine, social scientists Anne and Gerard Henderson. The Hendersons stopped by to see me one day in Washington and told me about their daughter, who was attending university in Australia. "Our daughter Johanna is 21 years old," explained Gerard. One day she and the girl she was sharing a flat with got a letter from the Australian phone company, Telstra, announcing that one-third of the company was being privatized, and every householder who had a Telstra phone was entitled to buy a batch of shares. She called up and asked if she should do it, and we said yes. So she took up the offer. She has very little money. It was $3 Australian a share, and she bought 300 shares. She hasn't even started to earn a salary yet. She might be a librarian or a teacher or a good hard-working wage earner, but she is the only one in the family who took up the Telstra offer. The workers in Telstra bought up about 90% of the shares offered, and they have become less militant since. People just understand that this sort of thing is important. The conservatives used the anti-globalization arguments to defeat Paul Keating's Labor government in 1996, and then they simply embraced the same arguments. There is no alternative unless you want to go backward. 10 years ago, my daughter would have gone with the flow against globalization, but a few shares of Telstra, which was all she could afford, has suddenly made her interested in what happens in Wall Street, because that affects her now. That's the groundswell at work. If the intellectual critics of globalization would spend more time thinking about how to use the system and less time thinking about how to tear it down, they might realize what a lot of these little folks have already realized, that globalization can create as many solutions and opportunities as it can problems. But can it create the biggest solution of all? Is there anything about globalization and the rise of the Internet and other modern technologies that can make a difference for those at the bottom of the bottom of the barrel, the 1.3 billion people still living on $1 a day? A lot of politically correct nonsense has been written about this question. Globalization critics will trot out all sorts of statistics that indicate that 90% of the world, or some such figure, doesn't have a telephone or has never made a phone call. Therefore, they argue, globalization and the rise of the Internet can and will do nothing for them, only widen the gap between them and the rest of the world. This is simply wrong. To begin with, it is wrong on the level of technology. While it may be true that in the year 2000 most people on the planet have never made a phone call, it will not be true by 2005, and it will be history by 2010. According to telecommunications industry estimates, by roughly 2005, 1 billion low-cost portable Internet connections will be deployed around the world, be they through cell phones, pagers, or Palm Pilots. And by 2010, there will be about 3 billion deployed. Since there are only a billion families on the planet, and these devices will become incredibly cheap, there is no reason that the vast majority of the poor won't be wired. A techie friend of mine figures that by 2010, about 100 million toasters should be online, as every piece of electronics gets fitted for software and becomes networked. Therefore, the real question is whether once this technology is widely available, will it be able to make a difference in combating poverty in ways that previous technological leaps have not? In raising this question, I do not mean to suggest that technology or its absence is the only variable in combating poverty. In fact, how societies are governed remains the most important variable. Creating a stable political, legal, and economic environment friendly to entrepreneurship, in which people can start businesses and raise their productivity, is the precursor for effectively fighting poverty anywhere. As Nobel Prize economist Amartya Kumar Sen makes clear in his outstanding book, Development as Freedom, freedom, the ability of a person to make decisions about his or her life, is not only the most efficient means for building a healthy, developed society, but also its ultimate goal. When you put assets in the hands of the poor in a politically distorted environment such as Liberia or Burma, not much happens. But when you put assets in the hands of the poor in reasonably stable and free environments, a lot will happen. That's why, as Sen points out, there has never been a famine in a country that is democratic, has multi-party politics, and a free media, including modern India. Political freedom, Sen notes, gives voice to the vulnerable sections of the population and provides them with the power to demand and receive protective support in times of emergency crisis. Poor countries such as Kenya and Zambia have fallen behind in the globalization age, not because globalization failed them, but because they failed to put in place even the minimum political, economic, and legal infrastructure to take advantage of globalization. Prosperity did not run away from them. They failed to make the choices that would encourage it to stay. Countries such as Uganda, Poland, or South Korea have made the right choices and reaped the benefits. Nations don't fail to develop, per se. They fail to develop good government. As such, we can refine the key question even more. Is there something about globalization that can both enhance freedom and contribute to the alleviation of poverty in ways that previous systemic changes and technological leaps have not? The answer on both counts is yes. I have already tried to explain in chapters 9 and 10 how globalization can promote better, more accountable government and give individuals, activist groups, and companies much greater power to become shapers of the new world without walls. What's noteworthy is how much the poor are beginning to understand this and exploit it. As harsh as the globalization system can be, it also gives those brutalized by it a greater ability to tell people about their pain or get organized to do something about it. And this helps explain and sustain the groundswell. Thanks to the Internet, for instance, it is no longer just the few big media conglomerates who talk to the many. It is now the many who can talk to the many. I learned this from Chandra Muzaffar, president of a Malaysian human rights organization called International Movement for a Just World. I went to see this gentle Malaysian Muslim at his barren office in a suburb of Kuala Lumpur. I went for the express purpose of hearing him blast globalization in the name of the left-outs and left-behinds, for whom his organization is such a strong advocate. But I got a subtler, more interesting message from him. "I think that globalization is not just a rerun of colonialism," said Muzaffar. "People who argue that have got it wrong. It is more complex than that. Look around. As a result of globalization, there are elements of culture from the dominated peoples that are now penetrating the North. The favorite food of Brits eating out is not fish and chips today, but curry. It is no longer even exotic for them. But I am not just talking about curry. Even at the level of ideas, there is a certain degree of interest in different religions now. So while you have this dominant force, Americanization, you also have a subordinate flow the other way. There are opportunities now for others to state their case through the Internet. Iran is highly linked to the Internet. They see it as a tool they can use to get their point of view across. In Malaysia, Mahathir now gets some coverage all over the world through CNN. The campaign for banning landmines was launched through the Internet. This is what globalization does for marginalized groups. To argue that it is just a one-way street is not right, and we should recognize its complexity. People operate at different levels. At one level, they can be angry about injustices being done to their society from Americanization, and then talk about it over McDonald's with their kids who are studying in the States. That's the groundswell meeting the backlash. It is true even in the most developed societies. Forbes magazine, hardly an advocate of the no-knots, ran a very smart piece in July 1998 after Time Warner CNN's disastrous June 7, 1998 report that U.S. Green Berets had deliberately nerve-gassed turncoats in Laos in 1970. No sooner did the program air than U.S. Army veterans alleged that this so-called exposé about Operation Tailwind was based on spurious reporting and dubious sources. Despite numerous complaints, the global news giant CNN would not retract the story. Global news giants don't apologize to anyone, especially to some retired soldiers. Time Warner may have expected the resulting anger to subside, noted Forbes. But fighting mad, Vietnam vets mobilized on the Internet, the only medium easily available to them. Without the Internet, it would have taken months to dig up the facts, and by then few would have much cared. It allowed me to do in 3 days what CNN producer April Oliver did in 8 months, says Air Force Major General retired Perry Smith, CNN's military consultant, who quit the network in protest over the show, then helped rebut it. Smith says the night the show aired, he dashed off a list of questions about what really happened in Laos. Simply by pressing a button, he dispatched the questions to over 300 of his best sources. My email brain trust, explains Smith. The emails started flying from all over. Tailwind was classified top secret, so had the Vietnam vets had to wait for the Pentagon bureaucracy to decide whether or not to declassify information they needed to refute CNN, the furor over the story would have passed. But by using an email network, which cost them almost nothing, they were able to assemble on their own all the testimony they needed from soldiers who were on the scene at the time, and then stick it in CNN's face in a matter of days. In the end, the email-armed veterans, living off their pensions, forced CNN's high-priced president, Rick Kaplan, to go on his own network, looking like a pathetic deer caught in the headlights, disown his own story, and abjectly apologize over and over again in order to save his own job and restore some credibility to his network. The final score, Vietnam veterans with email, 1. Time Warner CNN, the world's largest media conglomerate, 0. But while the Internet and globalization can, and increasingly will, create more freedom of expression for individuals and more transparency in government, why do I believe it can also help the poor confront poverty in some unique ways? Because the Internet scales like no other technology, said Alan Hammond, chief scientist of the World Resources Institute. One website translated into Hindi, Mandarin, Swahili, and Spanish would have a potential user base of 2 billion people. It can help people, even the poorest people, invent their way out of poverty and create digital dividends rather than a digital divide. Consider just one example, the story of Bangladeshi-American banker Iqbal Z. Qatar. In early 1993, he explained, I was employed at an investment firm in New York, where my colleagues and I worked together on the same reports requiring cumbersome and frequent exchanges of floppy disks. When a simple link installed among our computers eliminated the need for physical exchange of disks, we produced reports faster and worked more comfortably and creatively. This reminded me of my experiences in a village in rural Bangladesh during the country's War of Independence in 1971. The war started in urban areas, forcing my family to take refuge in a relatively remote village. The region had no modern infrastructure except for 2 motorized boats that carried passengers and cargo between 2 towns and touched near this village as one of their stops in between. For several months, the war forced these boats to suspend their services. When they started running again, there was an immediate positive effect on village life. Farmers and fishermen received a better price for their produce, and more things became available for purchase. The improvement was so dramatic that even at the age of 13, I observed it clearly. In addition, during this period, I spent a whole day walking between two villages. My parents had sent me to a village 10 kilometers away to collect some medicine from a village pharmacist. After walking for most of the morning, I arrived at my destination only to learn that the pharmacist had left for the city to replenish his supplies. It took me all afternoon to walk back home. Thus, when the computer link in my office snapped in 1993, I saw the wasted day in 1971 in a new light. Connectivity is productivity, be it in a modern office or an underdeveloped village. Connection enables, disconnection disables. If connectivity meant productivity, recalled Kadir, then it must be a weapon against poverty. But how was my native Bangladesh doing in 1993 on this battlefront against poverty? Research made me rediscover that Bangladesh chugged along mostly without phones, causing me to wonder how much human energy was wasted in an unconnected nation of 120 million people. There were 2 phones per 1,000 people, and virtually none in rural areas where over 100 million of the population resided. This was particularly disturbing because it was a time when new forms of connectivity, such as the internet and email, were beginning to transform even mature economies, such as the United States. About this time, in 1993, I learned that the government of Bangladesh would initiate a process to issue cellular licenses in 1994. This was very relevant. To achieve rural connectivity, one would need to think in a new way and establish and operate a new telephone company, in this case, a cellular one, for which a license would be needed from the government. I had to organize quickly. Although attracting commercial investments for a telecommunications service in rural Bangladesh was perceived to be extremely difficult, I felt there had to be a way. If connectivity indeed meant productivity, there had to be a way to collect part of that productivity gain to pay for the necessary investment. The key point, I kept in mind, is not how much money a village has to purchase telephone services, but how much money the village can make if the services are made available. The villagers would pay for the phone service from what they make from the phone services. But how to get started? One bright spot in this gloomy situation was a remarkable institution called Grameen Bank, said Cotter. This micro-lending bank operated in 35,000 villages through 1,100 branches and 12,000 workers. Typically, a woman would borrow $100 to $200 without collateral from Grameen Bank to purchase, say, a cow. The cow would then produce milk that she would sell to her neighbors, enabling her to make a living and pay off the loan. This process allowed the poorest of the poor to stand up on their feet. To me, connectivity could play a similar role. I proposed that a cellular phone could serve as cow, at least from the perspective of the bank's borrowers. A woman could borrow, say, $200 from the bank, purchase a handset, and sell telephone services by going door to door to villagers, thereby making a living and thus paying off her loan. My proposal caught the attention of Muhammad Yunus, the remarkable founder of Grameen Bank, without whom none of this would have been possible. With Yunus encouraging me to explore the possibilities, I left my venture capital profession in early 1994 and convinced a socially conscious American investor named Joshua Mailman to form a company with me in New York. The result, 2 years later, was a partnership called Grameen Phone Limited, a commercial operation providing cellular services in both urban and rural Bangladesh. Grameen Bank's arm for administering the village phone operators typically selects women by past borrowing records with the bank. For instance, if a woman has demonstrated certain skills in learning new things, she is favored as a candidate for retailing phone services. Another factor is the location of her house. A central location in the village is preferred. Grameen also ensures that at least one member of the family of a village phone operator knows English letters and numbers. The average daily earning of $2 by phone operators is, of course, one indication of the phone's utility. However, there is also plenty of anecdotal evidence of how people living in villages with phones are thinking and doing things differently after the phones arrived. For instance, one lady is thinking about raising a large number of chickens, a business she had not pursued earlier for fear of not being able to call a veterinarian on time if the chickens developed a disease. Another man wants to cultivate bananas on a large scale because he is now able to obtain market prices on time to make the correct shipping decisions. One woman contacted the doctor in time to save her child, who was running a high fever. The migrant workers throughout the world with roots in Bangladeshi villages can now call home to know how their families are doing and if the money they are sending home is indeed reaching its destination. There is also a great deal of positive social impact. With some of the poorest women in the villages holding in their hands instruments of global communication, there are ripples in the highly stratified villages. Even a relatively rich person in the village is walking up to a poor woman's home for a service he needs. Cutter says that he takes several lessons away from this experience. One is that digital technologies should unleash new thinking and create new business models that could be appropriate for poor countries. But institutions need to be created in these countries that can deliver the technology to the common people so that they themselves can harness its power. That is what Grameen Phone did. Another lesson is that there is no such thing as economic development without entrepreneurship. Entrepreneurship is the most potent force for uplifting countries. And what the Internet and globalization can do, with some imagination, is enable even the poorest Bangladeshi to be entrepreneur. Since poor countries, by definition, have large, poor populations, they must rank the energy of the poor as one of their most important strengths to move such poor countries forward, concluded Cutter. In other words, the phone may be a cow for the lady who operates it, but it acts as a horse for the village, pulling the whole village out of poverty. What such stories teach us is that while globalization can produce a profound sense of alienation, as power keeps moving up to more and more abstract levels that are difficult to touch, affect, or even see, it can also do the opposite. It can push down to the local level and to the weakest individuals more power, opportunities, and resources to become shapers than ever before. These stories also help to explain why the backlash against globalization so far has not garnered enough critical mass anywhere to really disrupt this new system. Too many people still want into this system and are finding ways to get there, even if it is painful at times. That is because too many people in developing countries understand that globalization is a tool to make them better off, faster than anything they have ever had before. Is every job a good one? Absolutely not. Is everyone in Sri Lanka paid the same as everyone in Seattle? No. But are the jobs created by the electronic herd in developing countries better than the alternatives of grinding poverty or child prostitution? Absolutely. Are they the first and necessary step out of poverty? Absolutely. As economist Paul Krugman has bluntly pointed out, the raw fact is that every successful example of economic development this past century, every case of a poor nation that worked its way up to a more or less decent or at least dramatically better standard of living has taken place via globalization. That is, by producing for the world market rather than trying for self-sufficiency. Many of the workers who do that production for the global market are badly paid by first world standards. But to claim that they have been impoverished by globalization, you have to forget that those workers were even poorer before the new exporting jobs became available, and ignore the fact that those who do not have access to global markets are far worse off than those who do. Slate, November 23, 1999. This is why so many representatives from developing countries were so upset at the 1999 Seattle World Trade Organization Summit, when the United States and other developed countries threatened to cut them off from global trade unless they got their worker and environmental standards up in short order, which was just a politically correct pretext used by American labor unions to limit trade with those countries which have lower wages. Without those lower wages, these developing countries could never take the first step up the development ladder, which is the necessary precondition for them to improve their worker and environmental standards. No wonder, then, that the backlash against globalization is often stronger among Western intellectuals than emerging market workers, who may not like a lot of things about globalization, but who know that the alternatives are a lot worse. Sometimes the news is in the noise, in what is being shouted on the streets of Seattle and painted on the walls in graffiti. But sometimes the news is actually in the silence, in what isn't being said. The greatest wisdom you can acquire as a reporter is understanding the difference between the two, and knowing when the silence is speaking volumes. I feel that the most important news story from Asia and Russia in 1998 and 1999 was the relative silence with which the lower and middle classes in Thailand, Korea, Malaysia, Indonesia, and the former Soviet Union accepted the verdict of the global markets, that their countries had fundamental software and operating system problems, and were ready to take the punishment and are now trying to make the necessary adjustments. How long this will last is impossible to predict, but it keeps confounding all those who have been predicting globalization's imminent demise. After every global economic disturbance, or after every Indian nuclear test, or every noisy Seattle WTO summit, some pundit writes that it all goes to show that globalization is finished, the system is breaking down, and the poor will rise up against it. Globalization is forever being buried by people who don't understand the first thing about it, or about people's real aspirations, and who have never spoken to the likes of Liliana, or Tira, Chandra, or Iqbal, the Henderson's daughter, or the miners in Russia, let alone to a little old lady with a scale in Hanoi. When all of them give up trying to be in the fast world, and when all of them declare that they would rather go back to their old, closed, regulated systems and give up trying for a better lifestyle for them or their kids, then I will acknowledge that globalization is finished and that the backlash has won. Until then, let me share a little secret I've learned from talking to all these folks. With all due respect to revolutionary theorists, the wretched of the earth want to go to Disney World, not to the barricades. They want the Magic Kingdom, not Les Miserables. And if you construct an economic and political environment that gives them half a sense that with hard work and sacrifice they will get to Disney World and get to enjoy the Magic Kingdom, most of them will stick with the game for far, far longer than you would ever expect. Part 4. America and the System. Chapter 17. Rational Exuberance. When Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan made his famous comment in early 1997, warning investors in the U.S. stock markets against irrational exuberance because of the way they were pushing up share prices beyond any seemingly rational price-earnings calculations, I wrote a column in the form of a letter to Greenspan, as though he were an advice doctor at a newspaper. It began like this. Dear Dr. Greenspan, I have a terrible problem. I'm feeling irrationally exuberant about the U.S. stock market, and I just can't shake it. I know you've said irrational exuberance is bad for my health, and I've tried everything. Hypnosis, Valium, short selling, even rereading your speeches from 1987. But nothing works. Every time I come to Europe or visit Japan, I return home itching to invest more in the U.S. market. Please, please help me. Sincerely yours, Mr. Full E. Invested. I went on to say that I didn't know what the right level of the U.S. stock market should be, and believed that if America didn't continue to do the basics of increasing productivity and keeping interest rates and inflation down, the stock market would go down just as it had gone up. But the point I wanted to make was that if there was some extra zip in the U.S. markets, it was not only because there was plenty of irrational exuberance about the American economy, but also because there was some rational exuberance about America as well. Since I spend a great deal of time overseas and away from Wall Street, looking at my country from the outside in, I am constantly exposed to the rational exuberance about America in the rest of the world. This rational exuberance is built on the following logic. If you look at globalization as the dominant international system today, and you look at the attributes that both companies and countries need to thrive in this system, you have to conclude that America has more assets and fewer liabilities in relation to this system than any other major country. This is what I call rational exuberance. It is the intuition among global investors that while many in Europe and Asia were still trying to adjust their societies to globalization, and some were barely up to the starting line, Uncle Sam was already around the first turn and in full sprint. A useful way to analyze this rational exuberance is to ask the following question. If 100 years ago you had come to a visionary geo-architect and told him that in the year 2000 the world would be defined by a system called globalization, what sort of country would he have designed to compete and win in that world? The answer is that he would have designed something that looks an awful lot like the United States of America. Here's what I mean. First of all, he would have designed a country that was in an ideally competitive geographic position. That is, he would have designed a country that was both an Atlantic and a Pacific power, looking comfortably in both directions, and at the same time connected by landmass to both Canada and Latin America, so that it could easily interact with all three key markets of the world, Asia, Europe, and the Americas. That would come in handy. He would have designed a country with a diverse, multicultural, multi-ethnic, multilingual population that had natural connections to all continents of the globe, but was at the same time bound together by a single language, English, which would also be the dominant language of the Internet. He would also have bestowed upon this country at least five different regional economies joined by a single currency, the dollar, which would also be the reserve currency for the rest of the world. Having a single country with different regional economies is a great asset, because when one region might be slumping, the other could be surging, helping to smooth out some of the peaks and valleys of the business cycle. All of that would be helpful. He would have designed a country with extremely diverse, innovative, and efficient capital markets, where venture capitalism was considered a noble and daring art, so that anyone with a reasonable or even ridiculous invention in his basement or garage could find a venture capitalist somewhere to back it. That would be nice, because when you talk about speed, nothing is faster at throwing money at new ideas than American capital markets. If you compare a list of the 25 biggest companies in Europe 25 years ago with a list of the 25 biggest European companies today, the two lists are almost the same. But if you take a list of the 25 biggest companies in America 25 years ago and compare it with a list of the 25 biggest American companies today, most of the companies are different. Yes, America's financial markets, with their constant demands for short-term profits and quarterly earnings, often won't let corporations waste money by focusing on long-term growth. That's true. But these same markets will give someone with a half-baked idea $50,000 overnight to try to turn it into the next Apple computer. Massachusetts has a bigger venture capital industry than all of Europe combined. Venture capitalists are very important people in this day and age, and not just as a source of money. The best of them provide real expertise for startup companies. They see a lot of them, and they understand the stages through which companies have to go in order to develop, and they can help carry them through, which is often as important as seed money. Our geo-architect would certainly have designed a country with the most honest legal and regulatory environment in the world. In this country, both domestic and foreign investors could always count on a reasonably level playing field, with relatively little corruption, plenty of legal safeguards for any foreigner who wants to make an investment and take out his profits at any time, and a rule of law that enables markets and contracts to work, and safeguards and encourages innovation through patent protection. The U.S. capital markets today are not only more efficient than those of any other country, they are also the most transparent. The U.S. stock market simply will not tolerate secrecy, so every listed company must file timely earnings reports along with regularly audited financial statements so that mismanagement and misallocation of resources is easily detected and punished. He would have designed a country with a system of bankruptcy laws and courts that actually encourages people who fail in a business venture to declare bankruptcy and then try again. Perhaps fail again, declare bankruptcy again, and then try again before succeeding and starting the next Amazon.com without having to carry the stigma of their initial bankruptcies for the rest of their lives. In Silicon Valley, says renowned venture capitalist John Doerr, it is okay to fail, and in fact, it might even be important that you failed before on someone else's money. In Silicon Valley, bankruptcy is viewed as a necessary and inevitable cost of innovation, and this attitude encourages people to take chances. If you can't fail, you won't start. Harry Saul, who founded one of the most successful software diagnostic systems in Silicon Valley, after being involved in several startup ventures that went belly up, once told me over coffee in Palo Alto, "The view here is that you are always better and wiser for having failed, which is why when people here fail after having tried something, they often have an easier time raising money the next time around. People say, 'Oh, he went bankrupt on that first venture? I bet he learned something from that, so I'll bankroll him again.'" In Europe, bankruptcy carries a lifelong stigma. Whatever you do, do not declare bankruptcy in Germany. You, your children, and your children's children will all carry a lasting mark of Cain in the eyes of German society. If you must declare bankruptcy in Germany, you are better off leaving the country, and you'll be welcomed with open arms in Palo Alto. On that subject, our geo-architect would certainly have designed a country that was hardwired for accepting new immigrants, so that in theory anyone could come to its shores and be treated as constitutionally equal to anyone else, thus enabling that country to be constantly siphoning off the best brains in the world and bringing them together in its companies, medical centers, and universities. Roughly one-third of Silicon Valley's scientists and engineers today are foreign-born immigrants who then turn around and project Silicon Valley values and products all over the world. According to University of California at Berkeley urban affairs expert Annalise Saxenian, research by the Public Policy Institute of California found that in 1996, 1,786 Silicon Valley technology companies with $12.6 billion in sales and 46,000 employees were run by Indian or Chinese immigrant executives alone. Donald Rice, the former boss at Teledyne, started a biotech company, Urogenesis, in 1997 to work on cures for prostate problems. He based his company in Santa Monica, California. One day, he described his staff for me. "We have 19 employees, 3 were born in Vietnam, 2 scientists, and 1 administrator. 2 were born in Canada, both scientists. 1 was born in Germany, a scientist. 1 was born in Peru, a scientist. 1 was born in Malaysia, a scientist. 1 was born in China, a scientist. One is from Iran, a scientist, and one is from India, a scientist. The rest of us are native-born Americans. I cannot think of another country in the world where you could so easily put such a team together. That's for sure. Has anyone out there tried to become a Japanese citizen lately? How about a Swiss? To be a Japanese, you pretty much have to be born a Japanese. To be a Swiss, you pretty much have to be born a Swiss. To be an American, you just have to want to be an American. That doesn't mean that we let everyone in who wants to be an American, but when citizenship is a legal question, not an ethnic, racial, or national one, it makes it much easier for a country to absorb new talent. As a friend of mine in Silicon Valley likes to say, I'm not afraid of Japan or the other Asians. Our Asians will beat their Asians any day. The more knowledge workers you can attract to your shores, the more successful you will be. As far as America is concerned, I say bring them in, and not only the rich, educated entrepreneurs. I would never turn back a single Haitian boat person. Anyone who has the smarts and energy to build a raft out of milk cartons and then sail across the Atlantic to America's shores is someone I want as a new immigrant. As T.J. Rogers, chief executive of Cypress Semiconductor, remarked while complaining about limits set by Congress on the number of temporary work visas allotted for foreign engineers, the winners and losers in the information age will be differentiated by brain power, but we have senators who don't see that. They want to send back the first-round draft choices of the intellectual world so that they can compete against us in their homelands. 4 out of my 10 vice presidents are immigrants. Some 35% of my engineers are immigrants. My vice president of research, the guy who designs my most advanced chips, is from Cuba. Would you like the jobs in your country depending on only the engineers your country could produce? Or would you like to have access to the top 10% of all engineers in the world? America is the only country that really has that access today. Japan, Switzerland, Germany, they have no real traditions of immigration, and that will be a huge disadvantage for them. Our geo-architects certainly would have designed a country with a democratic, flexible, federal political system that allows for a high degree of decentralized political decision-making, and therefore enables different regions and localities to adjust themselves to world trends without waiting for the center to move. Indeed, a federal system, with 50 states all having an incentive to compete and experiment in finding solutions to the intertwined problems of education, welfare, and healthcare, is an enormous asset in the era of globalization. When such problems can be highly complex, and you rarely get the right answer without experimenting a few times. Our geo-architect certainly would have designed a country with the most flexible labor market in the world, one that enables workers to move easily from one economic zone to another, and one that enables employers to hire and fire workers with relative ease. In a period of rapid change, ease of movement is critical. In America, lose your job in Maine one day, and you can get a new one in San Diego the next day, if you're prepared to move. Lose your job in Tokyo one day, and I wouldn't recommend looking for one in Seoul the next. Lose your job in Munich one day, and even with a common European currency and market, it is not so easy to get one the next day in Milan. That is a real liability. Moreover, the easier it is to fire workers, the more incentive employers have to hire them. This little paradox is one of the explanations, maybe even the most important explanation, for why America has so outpaced both Japan and Western Europe in the 1990s in absorbing the information revolution into its economy. Ask yourself a simple question. Why is it that when technologies from the internet to personal computers are available to every developed country, some adopt them quickly into their businesses and others don't? Well, the short answer is that most of these new technologies improve productivity in a factory and living standards in a society because they displace labor. The robot does the job more efficiently than an assembly line worker. The voicemail chip in your phone does the job better than an operator. In other words, the key to the information revolution is not that it increases labor output per unit, but rather that it reduces the labor input per unit, with all the efficiencies and cost savings that entails. The amount of physical labor required to do any task gets reduced. That means if you have a culture and society that allows you to easily and freely displace workers with new technologies, then you will reap the benefits they offer in terms of improved productivity, improved profits, greater general prosperity, and ultimately, more job creation. It all adds up to a more competitive country. America today has a society and culture in which Schumpeterian creative destruction is allowed to work. Alan Greenspan once pointed out that in mid-1999, roughly 300,000 jobs were getting destroyed by new technologies in America every week. But 300,001 new jobs were also being created by these new technologies each week, which is why America's aggregate unemployment rate was holding steady at a low level, because American companies can easily fire workers and displace them with technologies. They are unafraid to purchase these new technologies, and they can more easily pay for them by getting rid of a worker. But that also makes them much less afraid to hire people. In Europe and Japan, by contrast, it is very hard to fire someone. So imagine if a new voicemail system came along that could really revolutionize your company's phone system and allow you to eliminate 10 phone operators. A typical Western European company would have to buy the new voicemail system and keep the 10 phone operators, or buy them out at a very high price. The result is that either that company is going to be very wary about hiring anyone, or it will forego buying the new technology because it can't afford to pay the bill for the new equipment and the wages for the old worker at the same time. The rate of return on the new capital investment would be too low. In that vein, it may turn out that one of the key turning points in American history, going into the millennium, was Ronald Reagan's decision to fire all of the striking air traffic controllers in 1981. No single event did more to alter the balance of power between management and workers, and thereby open the way for American companies to fire workers, absorb the information revolution, and be able to hire more workers. No wonder, then, that millions of jobs were eliminated in America and many millions more created in America in the 1990s. While the labor market in Western Europe was largely stagnant, with unemployment frozen in the 12% range, our geo-architect would have designed a country where government-protected cartels are abhorred, so every company and bank has to fight and stand on its own, and monopolies will not be tolerated. That would be important. Even when a U.S. firm becomes a much-envied world-class gem, like Microsoft, it still has to answer to the Justice Department Antitrust Division. That is one of America's great hidden strengths. People who say that America, to preserve its strength, must preserve giant companies like Microsoft, no matter what they do, have it all wrong. It is the fact that a bunch of Justice Department lawyers making $75,000 a year could take on Microsoft, the biggest company in America, and win. That is the real source of our strength. There will always be another Microsoft as long as there is a Justice Department Antitrust Division ready and able to keep the road clear of monopolists, as well as judges such as Thomas Penfield Jackson, who are not afraid to throw the book at them. It was an ironic coincidence that Judge Jackson's November 1999 finding that Microsoft was a monopoly that had harmed consumers came down the same week as the 10th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. It is worth remembering what those people who tore down that wall wanted so badly on the other side. To be sure, they wanted what Bill Gates was selling, Windows, Disney World, Big Macs, and the good life, but they also wanted what Judge Jackson was selling, the rule of law. And if post-communist societies have learned anything in these past 10 years, It is that the rule of law is the foundation on which all of America's prosperity is built. As Russia, most of all, has discovered, no prosperity is sustainable without it. It's America's rules-based system of governance, in which no person or company is above the law, which is at the core of the American way. I was as distressed as anyone about the reports of alleged Chinese stealing of U.S. nuclear secrets in 1999. That is intolerable. But at the same time, I couldn't help but feel there was something pathetic about what the Chinese were alleged to be doing. Because our biggest secret, the real source of our strength, is one that they can't steal. It's how we live. When the Chinese photocopy that, then I will start to worry about them as competitors. But as long as they are just trying to steal our latest military secret, they should know that as soon as they steal it, our system will produce a better one. Our geo-architect would have designed a country that is tolerant of the oddball. The guy with the ponytail, or the gal with the ring in her nose, who is also a mathematical genius or software whiz. America is a country where the minute one person stands up and says, "That's impossible," someone else walks in the door and announces, "We just did it." Says Intel Vice President Avram Miller, "The Japanese don't get it, because they are focused on homogeneity. When it was building a gazillion of all the same thing, they were the world experts, and we mistook it for some special genius. But the world does not want a lot of the same thing today, and in a world where everyone wants something different, and the technology that will give them something perfectly tailored to their own needs and specifications, America has a real advantage." Our geo-architect would have designed a country whose corporate sector, unlike Europe's or Japan's, had by the mid-1990s already gone through most of the downsizing, privatizing, networking, deregulation, re-engineering, streamlining, and restructuring required to fully adjust to and exploit the democratizations of finance, technology, and information, and to avoid microchip immune deficiency. And just as America won the space race, it is now winning the cyberspace race. American companies spend more on information technology per capita than any others in the world. He also would have designed a country with a deeply rooted entrepreneurial culture and a tax system that allows the successful investor or innovator to hold on to a large share of his or her capital gains, so there is a constant incentive to get enormously rich. In our ideal country, Horatio Alger is not a mythical character, but sometimes your next-door neighbor, who just happened to get hired as an engineer at Intel or America Online when they were getting started and ended up being paid in stock options that are now worth $10 million. Our geo-architect certainly would have designed a country that still had a lot of environmentally attractive, wide-open spaces and small towns to attract knowledge workers. Because today, thanks to the Internet, fax machines, and overnight package delivery, high-tech firms and knowledge workers can escape from urban centers and settle virtually anywhere they want. So having lots of lush green valleys not far from oceans or mountains can be a real asset. That's why states like Idaho, Washington, Oregon, Minnesota, and North Carolina have booming high-tech sectors today. He would have designed a country that values the free flow of information so much that it defends the rights of the worst pornographers and the most incendiary racists to do their things. That would be an asset, because in a world in which information, knowledge, goods, and services will flow with increasing speed across the fast world or through cyberspace, those countries comfortable with such openness and the cacophony and chaos that sometimes attend it, those countries comfortable competing on the basis of imagination, not behind walls of protection, will have a real advantage. America, with its Freedom of Information Act, which barely allows the government to keep secrets for long, has nurtured this culture of openness from its foundation. And most important, our geo-architect would have designed a country whose multinational companies and little entrepreneurs are increasingly comfortable thinking big and thinking globally, and excel now in virtually every fast, light, networked, knowledge-intensive field of endeavor. America today excels at software design, computing, internet design, internet marketing, commercial banking, email, insurance, derivatives, genetic engineering, artificial intelligence, investment banking, high-end healthcare, higher education, overnight package delivery, consulting, fast food, advertising, biotechnology, media, entertainment, hotels, waste management, financial services, environmental industries, and telecommunications. It's a post-industrial world, and America today is good at everything that is post-industrial. In a winner-take-all world, America, for the moment at least, certainly has the winner-takes-a-lot system. This makes America a unique superpower. It excels in the traditional sources of power. It has a large standing army, equipped with more aircraft carriers, advanced fighter jets, transport aircraft, and nuclear weapons than ever, so that it can project more power farther than any country in the world, and deeper, too. The fact that America has both a B-2 long-range stealth bomber and the short-range F-22 stealth fighter now being developed means that the U.S. Air Force can fly into any other country's air defense system virtually undetected. At the same time, as detailed above, America excels in all the new measures of power in the era of globalization. But remember this. Only a decade ago, the Asians and the Europeans seemed to be dominant, and America in declinism was all the rage. Now, as John Neufer, an American analyst at the Mitsui Marine Research Institute in Tokyo, told the New York Times, everything is suddenly reversed. The Japanese don't see the light at the end of the tunnel, and Americans don't see the cliff they may walk over. That doesn't mean there are no cliffs out there. There always are. Whatever organic competitive advantages America may possess at this moment in history, it still has to get the basics right in order to compete. It still must ensure that productivity, the ability to produce goods and services at lower and lower costs so that wages can rise without inflation, steadily improves. The upsurge in productivity America witnessed in the late 1990s was a new technologically driven phenomenon, and it is not at all clear if growth will continue at such a high rate, slow back down to the slower pace of the previous 25 years, or speed up. Japan, for the moment, may have more liabilities than assets in this era of globalization, but Japan, in many key industries, is still an enormously effective manufacturer, with an always useful high savings rate and a very hard-working populace. Japan is also still an engine of innovation in areas such as high-end manufacturing, inventory management, and electronics. There are a lot of good Japanese entrepreneurs who have simply been stifled by their system. So Japan's macroeconomic stumblings in the 1990s do not make it a bust. They just require it to adjust. As long as the Japanese and Western Europeans stick with their rigid, protected welfare systems, which by making capitalism less destructive, also make it less creative and enriching, they won't be a challenge to America. But the farther ahead America gets in this era of globalization, the more I expect these countries will seek to mirror and mimic America. This inevitable adjustment will be enormously painful, but they will be forced to do it in order to maintain anything like their current standards of living. It is not that these societies are not producing entrepreneurial minds suited for this era. French brains work just like American brains. The only question is, what is the economic and social context in which those brains are allowed to flourish and develop? The reason many of France's best software engineers have flocked to Silicon Valley is that they simply do not feel they can thrive in today's French system. On March 21, 1998, the Washington Post reported from Paris about the brain drain from France to Silicon Valley because of the flexibility offered by the American system. Reza Malikzadeh, a 24-year-old graduate of one of France's most prestigious business schools, moved to the States, changed jobs 3 times in 3 years, and had become director of U.S. operations for the network systems firm Softway International, Incorporated in San Francisco. "I couldn't do in France what I do here," he said. "In France, even when you are 50 years old, they talk about you as a product of the school you went to. Here, people only care about what you can do, not how old you are or where you went to school 15 years ago." He is now one of the 40,000 French citizens living in Northern California. Change the context in France, and no doubt many of them will return, and fewer will come to Silicon Valley. America also must use this moment, when it has a few extra assets, to deal with its still very real liabilities: crime-ridden inner cities, an insane lack of gun control, widening income gaps, underfunded public schools, a culture of litigation that can be debilitating to everyone from small businessmen to large corporations, an underfunded Social Security system, a consumer credit card culture that encourages too many people to spend too far beyond their means and rack up a mountain of consumer debt that, in the event of a recession, could pose a real danger to the whole financial structure, and a political system increasingly perverted and corrupted by lax campaign finance laws. Addressing these problems would really come in handy in the era of globalization. I remain hopeful that America will use its assets wisely, and I don't think I am alone in this rational exuberance. But if we get complacent, bust will follow boom as surely as the dusk follows the dawn, which is why I always heed the words of Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, who liked to say about America in the 1990s, "The only thing we have to fear is the lack of fear itself." Chapter 18. Revolution is U.S. Sooner or later, McDonald's is in every story. Where did O.J. eat just before the murder of Nicole? McDonald's. What did Commerce Secretary Ron Brown serve U.S. troops just before he died? McDonald's. Saying in the press office at McDonald's headquarters in Oak Brook, Illinois. How can you shout death to America when you're wearing blue jeans? 21-year-old female Iranian student Riley commenting to New York Times reporter John Burns about the other students in the protest rally in Tehran marking the 20th anniversary of the Iranian Revolution, November 4, 1999. Oh, what some power the gifty gie us to see ourselves as others see us. Robert Burns. I believe in the 5 gas stations theory of the world. That's right, I believe you can reduce the world's economies today to basically 5 different gas stations. First, there is the Japanese gas station. Gas is $5 a gallon. 4 men in uniforms and white gloves with lifetime employment contracts wait on you. They pump your gas, they change your oil, they wash your windows, and they wave at you with a friendly smile as you drive away in peace. Second is the American gas station. Gas costs only $1 a gallon, but you pump it yourself. You wash your own windows, you fill your own tires, and when you drive around a corner, 4 homeless people try to steal your hubcaps. Third is the Western European gas station. Gas there also costs $5 a gallon. There is only 1 man on duty. He grudgingly pumps your gas and unsmilingly changes your oil, reminding you all the time that his union contract says he only has to pump gas and change oil. He doesn't do windows. He works only 35 hours a week, with 90 minutes off each day for lunch, during which time the gas station is closed. He also has 6 weeks vacation every summer in the south of France. Across the street, his 2 brothers and uncle, who have not worked in 10 years because their state unemployment insurance pays more than their last job, are playing bocce ball. Fourth is the developing country gas station. 15 people work there, and they are all cousins. When you drive in, no one pays any attention to you because they are all too busy talking to each other. Gas is only 35 cents a gallon because it is subsidized by the government, but only one of the six gas pumps actually works. The others are broken, and they are waiting for the replacement parts to be flown in from Europe. The gas station is rather run down because the absentee owner lives in Zurich and takes all the profits out of the country. The owner doesn't know that half his employees actually sleep in the repair shop at night and use the car wash equipment to shower. Most of the customers at the developing country gas station either drive the latest model Mercedes or a motor scooter. Nothing in between. The place is always busy, though, because so many people stop in to use the air pump to fill their bicycle tires. Lastly, there is the communist gas station. Gas there is only 50 cents a gallon, but there is none, because the four guys working there have sold it all on the black market for $5 a gallon. Just one of the four guys who is employed at the communist gas station is actually there. The other three are working at second jobs in the underground economy and only come around once a week to collect their paychecks. What is going on in the world today, in the very broadest sense, is that through the process of globalization, everyone is being forced toward America's gas station. If you are not an American and don't know how to pump your own gas, I suggest you learn. With the end of the Cold War, globalization is globalizing Anglo-American-style capitalism and the golden straitjacket. It is globalizing American culture and cultural icons. It is globalizing the best of America and the worst of America. It is globalizing the American Revolution, and it is globalizing the American gas station. But not everyone likes the American gas station and what it stands for, and you can understand why. Embedded in the Japanese, Western European, and communist gas stations are social contracts very different from the American one, as well as very different attitudes about how markets should operate and be controlled. The Europeans and the Japanese believe in the state exercising power over the people and over markets, while Americans tend to believe more in empowering the people and letting markets be as free as possible to sort out who wins and who loses. Because the Japanese, Western Europeans, and communists are uncomfortable with totally unfettered markets and the unequal benefits and punishments they distribute, their gas stations are designed to cushion such inequalities and to equalize rewards. Their gas stations also pay more attention to the distinctive traditions and value preferences of their communities. The Western Europeans do this by employing fewer people, but paying them higher wages and collecting higher taxes to generously support the unemployed and to underwrite a goodie bag of other welfare state handouts. The Japanese do it by paying people a little less, but guaranteeing them lifetime employment, and then protecting those lifetime jobs and benefits by restricting foreign competitors from entering the Japanese market. The American gas station, by contrast, is a much more efficient place to drive through. The customer is king. The gas station has no social function. Its only purpose is to provide the most gas at the cheapest price. If that can be done with no employees at all, well, all the better. A flexible labor market will find them work somewhere else. Too cruel, you say? Maybe so, but ready or not, this is the model that the rest of the world is increasingly being pressured to emulate. America is blamed for this because in so many ways globalization is us, or at least perceived that way by a lot of the world. The three democratizations were mostly nurtured in America. The golden straitjacket was made in America and Great Britain. The electronic herd is led by American Wall Street bulls, the most powerful agent pressuring other countries to open their markets for free trade and free investment, is Uncle Sam, and America's global armed forces keep these markets and sea lanes open for this era of globalization, just as the British Navy did for the era of globalization in the 19th century. Joseph Nye, Jr., dean of the Harvard University Kennedy School, summarized this reality well when he noted, "In its recent incarnation, globalization can be traced in part back to American strategy after World War II and the desire to create an open international economy to forestall another depression and to balance Soviet power and contain communism. The institutional framework and political pressures for opening markets were a product of American power and policy, but they were reinforced by developments in the technology of transportation and communications, which made it increasingly costly for states to turn away from global market forces. In other words, even within the Cold War system, America was hard at work building out a global economy for its own economic and strategic reasons. As a result, when the information revolution and the three democratizations came together at the end of the 1980s, there was a power structure already in place that was very receptive to these trends and technologies and greatly enhanced their spread around the world. As noted earlier, it was this combination of American power and strategic interests combined with the Made in America information revolution that really made this second era of globalization possible and gave it its distinctly American face. Today, globalization often wears Mickey Mouse ears, eats Big Macs, drinks Coke or Pepsi, and does its computing on an IBM PC using Windows 98 with an Intel Pentium 2 processor and a network link from Cisco Systems. Therefore, while the distinction between what is globalization and what is Americanization may be clear to most Americans, it is not, unfortunately, to many others around the world. In most societies, people cannot distinguish anymore among American power, American exports, American cultural assaults, American cultural exports, and plain vanilla globalization. They are now all wrapped into one. I am not advocating that globalization should be Americanization, but pointing out that that is how it is perceived in many quarters. No wonder the Japanese newspaper Nihon Keizai Shimbun carried a headline on June 4, 1999, about a conference in Tokyo on globalization that referred to the phenomenon as the American-instigated globalization. When many people in the developing world look out into this globalization system, what they see first is a recruiting poster that reads, "Uncle Sam wants you for the electronic herd." Martin Indyk, the former U.S. ambassador to Israel, told me a story that illustrates this point perfectly. As ambassador, he was called upon to open the first McDonald's in Jerusalem. I asked him what he said on the occasion of McDonald's opening in that holy city, and he said, "Fast food for a fast nation." But the best part, he told me later, was that McDonald's gave him a colorful baseball hat with the McDonald's logo on it to wear as he was invited to eat the first ceremonial Big Mac in Jerusalem's first McDonald's, with Israeli television filming every bite for the evening news. The restaurant was packed with young Israelis eager to be on hand for this historic event. While Ambassador Indyk was preparing to eat Jerusalem's first official Big Mac, a young Israeli teenager worked his way through the crowd and walked up to him. The teenager was carrying his own McDonald's hat, and he handed it to Ambassador Indyk with a pen and asked, "Are you the ambassador? Can I have your autograph?" Somewhat sheepishly, Ambassador Indyk replied, "Sure, I've never been asked for my autograph before." As Ambassador Indyk took the hat and prepared to sign his name on the bill, the teenager said to him, "Wow, what's it like to be the ambassador from McDonald's, going around the world opening McDonald's restaurants everywhere?" Stunned, Ambassador Indyk looked at the Israeli youth and said, No, I'm the American ambassador, not the ambassador from McDonald's." The Israeli youth looked totally crestfallen. Ambassador Indyk described what happened next. I said to him, "Does this mean you don't want my autograph?" And the kid said, "No, I don't want your autograph." And he took his hat back and walked away. No wonder that the love-hate relationship that has long existed between America and the rest of the world seems to be taking on an even sharper edge these days. For some people, Americanization globalization feels more than ever like a highly attractive, empowering, incredibly tempting pathway to rising living standards. For many others, though, this Americanization, globalization can breed a deep sense of envy and resentment toward the United States. Envy, because America seems so much better at riding this tiger, and resentment, because Americanization, globalization so often feels like the United States whipping everyone else to speed up, web up, downsize, standardize, and march to America's cultural tunes into the fast world. Envy, because America seems so much better at riding this tiger, and resentment, because Americanization, globalization so often feels like the United States whipping everyone else to speed up, web up, downsize, standardize, and march to America's cultural tunes into the fast world. While I am sure there are still more lovers of America than haters out there, this chapter is about the haters. It is about the other backlash against globalization, the rising resentment of the United States that has been triggered as we move into a globalization system that is so heavily influenced today by American icons, markets, and military might. As the historian Ronald Steele once pointed out, it was never the Soviet Union, but the United States itself that is the true revolutionary power. We believe that our institutions must confine all others to the ash heap of history. We lead an economic system that has effectively buried every other form of production and distribution, leaving great wealth and sometimes great ruin in its wake. The cultural messages we transmit through Hollywood and McDonald's go out across the world to capture and also undermine other societies. Unlike more traditional conquerors, we are not content merely to subdue others. We insist that they be like us, and of course, for their own good. We are the world's most relentless proselytizers. The world must be democratic. It must be capitalistic. It must be tied into the subversive messages of the World Wide Web. No wonder many feel threatened by what we represent. The classic American self-portrait is Grant Wood's American Gothic. The straight-laced couple, pitchfork in hand, expressions controlled, stoically standing watch outside the barn. But to the rest of the world, American Gothic is actually 2 20-something American software engineers who come into your country wearing long hair, beads, and sandals with rings in their noses and paint on their toes. They kick down your front door, overturn everything in the house, stick a Big Mac in your mouth, fill your kids' heads with ideas you've never had or can't understand, slam a cable box onto your television, lock the channel to MTV, plug an internet connection into your computer, and tell you, download or die. That's us. We Americans are the apostles of the fast world, the enemies of tradition, the prophets of the free market, and the high priests of high tech. We want enlargement of both our values and our Pizza Huts. We want the world to follow our lead and become democratic, capitalistic, with a website in every pot, a Pepsi on every lip, Microsoft Windows in every computer, and most of all, with everyone, everywhere, pumping their own gas. I saw the sign above the front door as soon as I walked into the lobby of the Homa Hotel in downtown Tehran in September 1996. Written there were the words, "Down with USA." It wasn't a banner. It wasn't graffiti. It was tiled into the wall. Geez, I thought to myself, that's tiled into the wall. These people really have a problem with America. A short time later, I noticed that the Iranian mullahs, who have always been more sensitive to the ups and downs of American cultural and military power than anyone else, had started calling the United States something other than just the Great Satan and the bastion of imperialism and Zionism. The Iranians had started to call America the capital of global arrogance. I found that a subtle but revealing shift. The Iranian leadership seemed to understand that global arrogance was different from imperialism. Imperialism is when you physically occupy another people and force your ways upon them. global arrogance is when your culture and economic clout are so powerful and widely diffused that you know that you don't need to occupy other people to influence their lives. As India's finance minister, Shri Yashwant Sinha, once said to me about America's relations with the rest of the world today, "There is no balance, no counterpoise. Whatever you say is law." And that is what makes today's combination of Americanization and globalization so powerful. What bothers so many people about America today is not that we send our troops everywhere, but that we send our culture, values, economics, technologies, and lifestyles everywhere, whether or not we want to or others want them. America is different. German foreign policy expert Josef Joffe noted in a September 1997 essay in Foreign Affairs, "It irks and domineers, but it does not conquer. It tries to call the shots and bend the rules, but it does not go to war for land and glory. The United States has the most sophisticated, not the largest, military establishment in the world, but it is definitely in a class of its own in the soft power game. On that table, China, Russia, and Japan, and even Western Europe, cannot hope to match the pile of chips the United States holds. People are risking death on the high seas to get into the United States, not China. There are not too many who want to go for an MBA at Moscow University or dress and dance like the Japanese. Sadly, fewer and fewer students want to learn French or German. English, the American-accented version, has become the world's language. This type of power, a culture that radiates outward and a market that draws inward, rests on pull, not push, on acceptance, not on conquest. Worse, this kind of power cannot be aggregated, nor can it be balanced. In this arena, all of them together, Europe, Japan, China, and Russia, cannot gang up on the United States as in an alliance of yesteryear. All their movie studios together could not break the hold of Hollywood, nor could a consortium of their universities dethrone Harvard. This is why the strategic partnership forged by Russia and China appears so anachronistic in 1997. What are they going to do about America? Boris Yeltsin will hardly want to shop for know-how and computers in Beijing. And China will not want to risk its most important export market. In the near term, it is only going to get worse, because the economic power gap between the United States and the rest of the world is going to widen more before it narrows. All you have to do is look at what is happening in cyberspace to understand that. There is a great land grab going on there, a grab for who will set up and own the key global commercial websites and cyber exchanges. A cyber exchange is a two-way auction site with multiple buyers bidding on offerings from multiple sellers. They usually start out as spot markets. Spot markets are vehicles for